Now, coming into this midterm election year, the expectation was that Republicans had a decent chance to take control of the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate. Could be a close call. That's in part because the party in the White House tends to lose seats in Congress in midterms. Now, months and millions of dollars in advertising later, it looks like Republicans have a decent chance to take control of the House, and the Senate is a close call. There's a lot at stake when it comes to control of Congress and a huge mix of issues that could influence voters. And while we, of course, don't know the results of the 2022 midterms, we're going to spend some time talking about what could happen in Congress depending on the outcomes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you have your eye on when it comes to midterm races? If Republicans take control of the House, Senate, or both, what are you hoping they do? What are you fearing they do? Same question if Democrats retain control of Congress. What thoughts do you have? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Julia Azari has been thinking a lot about this, teaching about it too. She's a professor of political science at Marquette University. She researches and teaches about the American presidency and political parties. She's author of the book Delivering the People's Message, The Changing Politics of the Presidential Mandate. Julia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we hear in many elections, this is among the most consequential of our lifetime, or phrases to that effect. How consequential, how important is this particular 2022 midterm election for Congress?
So I think there's sort of two answers to that question. One has to do with what kind of policies will come out of Congress if we have a divided government after this election. And I think there, you know, the question there is, what kinds of policies could we imagine a Republican White House, or excuse me, Republican House run led by Speaker Kevin McCarthy of California is kind of the presumptive candidate for that, and a Biden White House, regardless of who controls the Senate. I think the answer of what they might work on together is not very much. So I think we'll see something, if that happens, very similar to what we saw in the Obama years, where there's some brinksmanship over budget politics, where there's a lot of disagreement. There's a lot of messaging bills, a lot of kind of symbolic politics, knowing that very little will go forward. I think, you know, symbolically, and also in the realm of kind of some of the concerns that people have about the future of American democracy, we're going to see some really difficult questions come forward if this happens about how a Republican-led House kind of addresses some of the concerns that people had following the 2020 election. Do they follow what has become kind of standard opinion in the Republican Party about that election? Do they act on that in any way with regard to future elections? What will be their capacity to do that? So I don't want to downplay the very real, both symbolic and kind of really concrete consequences that can have from a policy perspective. I think we're looking at, you know, the possibility of a very deadlocked, divided government if that's what happens in November.
I understand you've been talking to your students about a similar situation. Again, a Democratic president, and if Republicans controlled the House, going back to 1994, I believe that was the Contract with America year, where you had a Democratic president, Bill Clinton, Republicans led by Newt Gingrich in the House. What lessons could we take from that?
Yeah, great question. I'm really excited to be dragging my students into what to them will feel like ancient history on Tuesday, which to me feels like fairly recent memory. 1994. So the Contract with America, what's interesting about that is that was a real kind of turn in congressional elections to really thinking about them as a kind of national event where people in different districts and states were running under kind of a similar banner. And the Contract with America really was kind of a House of Representatives thing. This year, the Republicans have sort of done something similar with a document called Commitment to America that has kind of their ideas about the state of the country and what they would do. There's a couple of interesting. So a key lesson, I think, is that not actually that many people are going to pay attention to this in the broader electorate. And now we think about this kind of national dimension as pretty natural part of elections. We would expect members of the same party to be on a similar kind of page. One thing that I thought was really striking from the Contract with America is that it largely avoided a lot of social issues, even though that was part of that campaign, was taking on what Bill Clinton had done in regard to social issues. But the document itself was really about economics, and it was kind of about governmental reform, changing the way things were done in Congress. This year, you know, the commitment to America does not shy away from these kind of divisive social issues. And I think that really shows you how much party politics has changed since then.
Talking to Julia Azari from Marquette University, looking at what's at stake in the midterm elections for control of Congress. Both chambers up for grabs. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, predictions, worries, questions. 800-642-1234 is the number. Tom joins us now in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I think in the past when we had presidents and the rest of the government in different houses, like Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill, for example, those are people in times when people could actually compromise and get together. But right now, we're looking at people like Kevin McCarthy and his cohorts basically saying that they're just going to let Donald Trump get away with armed insurrection. And they also want to use impeachment against Joe Biden and other people, Kamala Harris. And it just seems extreme to the extent where I really think democracy is in danger.
Tom, thanks for the call. Julia, what do you think?
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's been some pretty striking polling lately that shows that this is a widespread feeling among Americans, but also that people don't really have a sense of what to do about it. That's very striking to me. I think that the caller is kind of laying out a sense that a lot of people have, and that certainly, you know, if you've been watching the January 6th hearings and you have been kind of following what that committee, a sort of bipartisan committee, has been trying to do, it's, you know, a Republican House is not going to pick up on that work. That's just not going to happen. And I think that, you know, you always have kind of some seesawing between the two parties. But, you know, I think there are people who see that really as something much larger and having like a much longer term impact hanging in the balance. Impeachment, I think, is going to come up a lot. And I think it's important to think about impeachment as a kind of as something that reflects the politics going on in Congress. If the Democrats hold the Senate, the Senate is anybody's guess, then obviously, you know, a Republican House impeaching Biden, that those charges then won't really go anywhere in the Senate. And so I think it's important to think about what the political calculus will be for members of the House to do that. And on the one hand, it might be worth it to kind of do that in a messaging way and then say, look, these people didn't do anything. On the other hand, I think the reason even though we have this incredible partisan rancor, we don't see more impeachment efforts is because impeachment really is, I think, still seen as very kind of politically fraught and potentially very costly process.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. I wanted to ask you about one possible tactic for a Republican-led chamber, one or both. The debt ceiling. And we've seen leading Republicans, including you mentioned likely Speaker, if the Republicans won the House, Kevin McCarthy, saying, yeah, we're probably going to use the threat of a shutdown over a vote on the debt ceiling to extract policy concessions as opposed to, you know, trying to just pass things that a president's going to veto. How important is that?
So it's hard to know at the outset exactly what these dynamics will be like, but that was certainly what we saw during the Obama years. And I think that one thing that's sort of critical about that is that it's really not evident that anyone paid a political price for that sort of budget kind of showdown that happened over the course of Obama's kind of the latter part of his first term in particular. And there was a, you know, very close to kind of crisis in the summer of 2011. And that was, you know, it wasn't really clear that the electorate honestly reacted very strongly to that, either to say, yes, we want to see more this sort of budget austerity, or no, we were very concerned about the U.S. defaulting on its debt. The policy consequences for the latter are something you should ask somebody who knows more about the global political economy. But my understanding is it's quite dire. It is not a joke. But I think that kind of really high stakes sort of party conflict was not uncommon in the Obama years. I can think of reasons why that might not be the tactic this time around. For all the kind of public politics has been every bit as nasty as it was in the Obama years, the sort of congressional actual legislating has been a little bit more bipartisan with the Biden administration. So you can imagine that might not necessarily be the case. But, you know, I don't really have any reason to believe either that the politics between the two parties will be a lot calmer than it has been in the past, or that anyone will shy away from very, like I said, very high stakes kinds of tactics.
We're talking to political science professor Julia Azari from Marquette University, looking at the midterm elections and what's at stake depending on which party emerges with control of one or both chambers of commerce. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are the most important things you see being at stake when it comes to which party controls Congress? What do you hope to see? What do you worry about depending on who ends up winning the control of the House in particular or the Senate? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about the midterm elections and the stakes for which party or parties control the House and Senate. Julia Azari stays with us, professor of political science at Marquette University. Still time for you to join in with your thoughts, hopes, fears, and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now with Justin in Algoma. Justin, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. My question for Professor Azara, is this a good time for a gridlock? If the Republicans win both houses, is it time for the states to step up and be a little bit less politically divided?
Interesting, Justin. If we can't get things done at the federal level, is this a time where states will take the forefront?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of agnostic on that question. I think there are ways in which when the states step up, that can be good. There's kind of clear ways that, you know, states have a lot of variety in the kinds of policies they might need. There's other ways where that can be really chaotic and, lead to a kind of situation in which you need some kind of central federal policy or where that becomes a way to make life worse for some people. So I think that really depends. I have been in the past like somewhat of a defender of gridlock in the sense that if the country is sort of split on something, then, you know, we should figure out a way to do something that a lot of people can agree on. The problem with that I see right now is something that people in the political science community have been talking about for some years now, which is this idea that what's driving the disagreement between the two parties isn't just issue disagreement. And you can have a really different position on an issue and still come to some agreement about what the problem is and find a compromise solution that doesn't do everything that anybody wants, but that does some things for kind of a wide range of people and that improves things on balance for as many people as possible. That is a thing that can happen, but it can't really happen when the two parties are fundamentally seeing each other as enemies. And there are people who have arguments about the way that this might not be symmetrical between the two parties. I don't think I have time to sort of go over all the different evidence, but it's clear that's part of the equation here is that it's not that there's gridlock because there's always disagreement on issues. It's that there's gridlock because one side doesn't want to hand the other side a win. And they see it as an opportunity for gain, an advantageous thing for them to kind of sabotage the other side. And that's, I think, sort of across a lot of different viewpoints among scholars and journalists in the political realm, that's the thing that I think we see is really, is really damaging to the governing process. That just makes governing impossible.
Justin, thanks for the call. Dennis joins us now in Two Rivers. Dennis, hello.
Yeah, that's what I was getting into, is it's, they kind of be like Groucho Marx. If the other side is for it, they're against it. Because sometimes, I mean, one example is when Trump was in office, he wanted to be sure he got his signature on the checks that went out to us. But then when the Democrats are in charge and they're sending out checks, then the Republicans are totally against it. So it just depends on whose idea it is and who's in charge.
Dennis, thanks for the call. Dennis referred to Groucho Marx as Rufus T. Firefly in the movie Duck Soup. But that, whatever it is, I'm against it. Negative polarization shaping actions for voters and for members of Congress, Dennis says, Julia.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know if I could have put it better. That's a really good example. What's interesting about that is that in the previous administration and also in this one, there have actually been things that have come out of Congress where they've managed to come up with some points of agreement. There was a kind of, I guess I would call it, it was a gun bill, but it was kind of like a broad context gun bill over the summer that dealt a lot with like mental health type of issues. And that was bipartisan. You had bipartisan infrastructure. You have the COVID relief in both administrations has had some support. That's just, you know, that's, it's not, this is the thing I think that a lot of people are finding very frustrating, is that certainly when you go out into the electorate, Republicans and Democrats have different viewpoints. They have reasons for their beliefs, but they also have concerns that they share in common and the possibility for compromise. And the current structure of our politics just is not terribly conducive to that. And there aren't a lot of political incentives for that. And that seems to be the sort of catch-22 that we are stuck in. And that, again, I think is kind of what we're looking at. When it comes to thinking about a possible divided government in 2023. So, I mean, I think that that's also something people can think about as far as those political incentives. Members of Congress behave the way they do because they think that's what they have, that's what's in their best political interest. And voters have some power there. And, you know, joining up with other people to kind of pressure members of Congress to compromise on important issues, that can work. I think that is probably the only thing that does work. And so I do want to sort of emphasize how I hear the frustration in each caller's comments and voice, but also to emphasize that we are still part of this equation as citizens.
Thanks for the call, Dennis. I want to spend a little bit of time, Julia, on, we've been talking about after the election and the what ifs. What might shape the outcomes? I won't ask you to make any predictions because who can really do that? But what are you watching for that could swing outcomes in one way or another?
Yeah, I mean, I think this has been really a challenging couple years in this regard because it's not totally obvious what shapes outcomes. The polls this fall look like they have shifted a lot toward the Republicans. Even that, there's a debate among experts about whether that's just a matter of shifting to looking at likely voters as opposed to just registered voters over the summer. That often is sort of a Republican shift. In terms of what happens in the next couple of weeks, honestly, the main thing I'm looking at is mobilization, is how the two sides are mobilizing their voters. And the last two elections, 2020 and 2018, have had very high turnout. And that turnout has been, those increases have been pretty even across the two parties. So it might be a wash. It certainly was in 2020, but I'll be looking at that because I think that's really the main thing that is going to make a difference. Now, I don't know that the things that the candidates are saying or doing is making a big difference at this point.
Over the last bunch of months since the overturning of Roe v. Wade, the Dobbs decision, we've seen a few elections, a referendum in Kansas, a couple of special House elections where there was kind of a hidden phenomenon, it seemed like, in the polling of younger women in particular becoming likely voters where pollsters might not have considered them that in the past. Do you think that's something that might hold in 2 weeks?
Yeah, I don't know. I've been puzzling a lot about this, and people have now been sharing early voting data to the extent it's available in Pennsylvania, here in Wisconsin, that I think does show a little bit of an advantage for women voters in Wisconsin. I'm very hesitant to put too much stock in early in like this sort of partial data, early voting data. But I think that you might see if there's that effect, I think it's likely to be small. That said, a lot of these races are really close. And the generic ballot for the House of Representatives is basically even. There's a number of critical races in the Senate, like six of those that are just incredibly close. In a close election, anything can matter, and a small change can make the difference. So I think that's the case. I do think what we're seeing in Senate races and in governor's races is that in this sort of bigger race than a House race, that there's just a more complex set of issues. Similarly with the Kansas referendum, which was very direct. It was very clear what people were voting on. And in a Senate race, we can pick up on a lot more different factors and dynamics. And so that might at least partially crowd out that issue.
Julia, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Julia Azari, professor of political science at Marquette University, author of the book Delivering the People's Message, The Changing Politics of the Presidential Mandate, with us for a look at the midterm elections and what's at stake when it comes to which party ends up controlling the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate.